All right, it's already time for my complaint show again. Hi, I'm Scott. This is my complaint show. I sit up here and talk about foreign policy. And I only have disapproving things to say about it, pretty much. But anyway, so yeah, you get to benefit from that. You know, if you see it that way. Today will be, at least half a police state show. It's going to be more than half a police state show rather than strictly foreign policy, because we've got John W. Whitehead coming on from the Rutherford Institute to talk about, I know y'all saw this coming, the DNA databases. Now, I know that under the overall rubric of government spying, data mining, privacy violating, you can go on all day, all night, forever, and never run out of stuff to cover. But the DNA thing, we've all seen this going on all the time, the different databases that they've talked about, they've been building up for years now. It seems to get very little coverage and very little critical analysis. So John Whitehead has begun to remedy that, at least, with this great new piece. And, you know, I got to say about John Whitehead, when he decides he's going to write about a thing, it's always 3,000 words worth of good reading all the way through. He's very thorough. Does a very good job. And wrote a really good one about the DNA databases and the end of liberty. It's only just now getting out of control. You thought it was bad before. John Whitehead. And then Will Grigg is going to be on. He's got some police state stuff to talk about, too. What's a human life worth to the American government? And what is a dog's life worth if that dog is itself a government employee? And how do we measure these things? Well, with legislation, of course. You already know the punchline, don't you? Oh, I won't ruin it if you can't figure it out. Will Grigg is going to be on the show. Now, you know, I don't want to get into that because that would ruin the joke. All right. There you go. John Whitehead, Will Grigg on the show. Tomorrow on the show, at least two of the three guests will be former CIA guys. I know, it sounds corrupt, doesn't it? But no, it's Ray McGovern and Phil Giraldi. They're great, man. And so Ray is going to be on to talk about the restructuring of the CIA. This is a really big deal. Now, of course, you and I and everyone with common decency would just have the CIA completely abolished. So it's a narrow point about what its structure should be, assuming its existence. But it shouldn't be what they're changing it to. Pretty sure about that. And if you go to antiwar.com/blog, you'll see a memo from the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity pleading for just a little sanity on this issue. And so that'll be that. And then also we're going to talk Ukraine, because there's some Ukraine talking to talk with the great Ray McGovern. And then Giraldi's going to be on about, get this, man, check out his new article at UNS.com. And this is actually the speech that he gave Sunday before last, I guess. Remember when he was on the show and he said he was going to give that speech at that bookstore? Well, he did. And it was called Shutting Down AIPAC, Removing Israel from American Politics. Yeah. Wouldn't that be great? At least the first part. And I'm usually not for, I don't know. I guess I have to say, I'm not for the U.S. government existing or anyone having to do anything at all that they say. On the other hand, though, I guess I sort of kind of, I don't know. As long as there's an empire, the Israel lobby should all have to register as agents of a foreign power and stop trying to pretend that they're American patriots when really they're not. And they put the interests of a foreign state far above and beyond the interests of their own. Yeah, no problem. It's okay to be a lobbyist for a foreign power, but you got to register as such with the State Department. And everywhere you go, you got to tell people, yeah, I get money by doing what a foreign country wants me to do. And, you know, you just have to have that on your record there. Pay a little, is there a fee? I guess you got to pay a fee for the license to represent the interests of a foreign power in your own country. So, anyway, but there's got to be more to it than that. We'll have Phil Giraldi on the show tomorrow to talk all about that. Shutting down AIPAC. All the good reasons to, and maybe a little bit of how. All right. So then, I guess housekeeping, I should say. Stop by my website, click on my sponsors and patronize them, and click on the archives. Join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. Got the usual suspects hanging out in there this morning. Hey, guys, how's things? I'm in there. That's scotthorton.org/chat. It's an IRC free node chat room. Hashtag Scott Horton Show, if you're into that kind of thing. In case you missed it, thank goodness you will not be able to see a video of my speech at the New Hampshire Liberty Forum. I mean, I agreed with everything I said in there and everything. It was all right. It was just kind of disjointed and all over the place and just not the best presentation. So anyway, I'm glad you can't watch that. I don't have to be embarrassed about that. I'm only as embarrassed as I am about the couple of dozen people who watched the thing. Hopefully they've all forgotten by now. But thank you to the Liberty Forum for having me out, and don't let that dissuade you, other people who would hire me to come and give a speech, because I know exactly what I would tell them now if I had a do-over. So I'll just do my do-over at your thing. Anyway, I like giving speeches. The New Hampshire Liberty Forum, that thing was cool, man. I saw real piles of snow, the kind of piles of snow that Texans don't usually ever get to see very often. And I got to meet Mark and Ian and Derek J. from the Victimless Crime Spree and a few others. And actually, a lot of great people I got to meet up there. And hang out with Jeff Tucker again. And so, yeah, man, it was cool. Thanks again for having me out there. All right, now, let me see what time the clock says. It says I got a couple of minutes to kill. I guess, you know what? I don't really want to talk about Rand Paul and Iran very much today, so I'll just do that now and get it out of the way. Rand Paul sucks. And I told you so. If it wasn't this, it'd be something else. And, you know, Justin Raimondo used to be really good on how bad Rand Paul was, and then he decided that, nah, he liked Rand Paul, and he's the last best hope for anything like better than what we got with the rest of these guys. And yeah, for the same reason the War Party hates him, his name. It's the same people, same reason that Justin and so many other libertarians want to like him. But I told Justin, hey man, the thing about the guy is he's not a good person. He's just not. And so he's going to keep doing wrong things, and at some point he'll cross the line. At some point he'll again make you remember why it was that you're so mad at him in the first place. And so apparently with this one, he's crossed Justin's line again. But how obvious is this? I mean, this could be such a gray issue for Rand to define himself and separate himself from the rest of the Republicans that, no, he doesn't support Obama, the politician, the Democrat. But if the president of the United States is trying to negotiate a de facto peace deal here, then, yeah, he supports that. And he could also support the facts against a bunch of scaremongering and hype. And he could win. But instead, nah. He's just nothing but Hillary Clinton with a perm, that's all. He's Ted Cruz. That's who Rand Paul is. Worthless. Scum. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. All right, so off Iran, but on the same subject still here, this letter from the Republican senators to the Iranians trying to screw up the politics of the Iran deal in Iran. Just try to try to undermine support for the effort to strike a deal on their end. Well, the president has said, Obama has accused the Senate Republicans of aligning themselves with hardliners in Iran's government in opposing the process, writes Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Of course, that's correct. The moderates, and I don't mean the fake, you know, centrist extremists, but I mean actual moderates, those who would moderate, are the enemy of the war party in America and in Iran. Think the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps wants a nuclear deal? Hell no. In fact, they're benefiting from the sanctions regime while the rest of Iranian society suffers. Guess who controls the black markets? Yeah, just like in America. The government. So they're the ones making all the money while everyone else is suffering. And, of course, the hawks benefit from being proven right about just how evil and incorrigible the other side is in virtually all cases. War is the health of the state. Diplomatic crises, too, to a lesser degree. And Barack Obama is absolutely right about that. In case you never heard this show before, I hated him before you, and I still do hate him more than you do. I'm not leaning liberal here. I think because Barack Obama has been an absolute and complete and total catastrophe and failure in every sense, he needs this one. He's even reinvaded Iraq, for Christ's sake. He needs to be good on something. And I think that, you know, I don't know, I don't know what's going to happen in Iran. But despite the Republican hawks in Congress, I believe that Kerry, and I'm trying so hard to be optimistic about this because I'm just sick of talking about it. It's been 10 years of debunking this lie in a row for me, and I've about had it more than that. I don't want to have to debunk it anymore. I'm sick of it. But so it's Kerry and Zarif, and they all know what the deal is, man. Eh, so-called breakout time is really only half a breakout time anyway, and they need to make it about a year or so, and that'll be good enough. And once Obama, despite what it says in that letter from the senators, I think once Obama gets the deal, assuming he gets the deal, then the politics really should shift to him. And now it's going to be, look, I have, you know, a de facto peace deal. I have severe assurance, good enough for all of our allies too, that Iran is not, does not have a parallel program or not seeking or designing or working on nuclear weapons in any way. And I've extended their breakout time to more than a year for at least the next 10 or 15 years or whatever. And seriously, you guys want to ruin that now? I think that he'll win on that. Assuming he can get the deal, I think that Congress will basically have to go along the same way as if he was starting a war, as he is often wont to do. in this case, it would be anyone. Now, here's my problem. And, you know, this is the same thing for 10 years straight, too. Back then, it was the Bush years, and Bush was fighting a war directly on behalf of the Iranians in Iraq. And I always said then, we ought to have a nuclear deal with them. We ought to have peace with them. We ought to not fight a war for them in Iraq. Why would we be allies of Iran in Iraq? Why would that make sense to serve their interests there? Same thing here under the damn Democrats. Where Obama and the Ayatollah are sending letters back and forth saying, hey, you know, if we could get this nuclear deal done, maybe we could work together against the Islamic State. Well, I got news for you. Half the reason the Islamic State exists is because George Bush sided with the Iranians and their sock puppets, who tortured people to death by the thousands, who murdered them by the hundreds and hundreds of thousands. The Badr Brigade, the Dawa Party, well, that's the army of the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party. Those are the two most important Shiite parties backed by the Iranians. They were the Iraqi traitors who, when Jimmy Carter hired Saddam Hussein to invade Iran, they fled to Iran and lived in Iran for 30 years. And then when George Bush invaded in 2003, they came right in on his heels. And then he fought a 8-year war for them, a 6-year, 7-year war for them. And the absolute bloodbath caused by George Bush serving as the useful idiot of the Ayatollahs in Iraq has resulted in the backlash of the creation of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, eventually what became the al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State, as a reaction to the American/Iranian invasion and conquering of the southeast of the country. So when you hear about, for example, right now there's a battle going on for Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown north of Baghdad, a super majority Sunni town when it has people in it. They've all fled now because there's a war going on there. But now, assuming that the Iranians and the Shiite militias and what's left of the Iraqi army, assuming that they're successful in taking Tikrit, they still have, you know, as Patrick Coburn writes, a booby trap war to fight and all this. It won't be easy to take over the whole city. But once they do, are they going to let the Sunnis come back? Or are they going to take it as a fait accompli? They've cleansed the city and now move in a bunch of Shiites from the south of the country. And then, assuming that happens, which just for the sake of argument for a minute, might not. And then how would that look for the rest of the, for Fallujah and for Mosul and the rest of the majority Sunni cities that still await so-called liberation? How much harder are they going to fight? Now, then again, it is true. I've seen that some of the tribal leaders have been meeting with some of the Shiite militia leaders and saying, man, we like you guys better than the Islamic State. Help us and we'll fight them. But there's a lot of mistrust. And there's a lot of momentum, too, so I don't know how it's going to be, but certainly it doesn't make sense. If the Iranians have decided that they want to back their pet militias in Iraq in what very well could be the vast worsening of the sectarian nature of the strife there, America ought to stay the hell out. Leave it to the damn Democrats. Right? Let's get this nuclear deal out of the way so that we can ally with each other at war. Oh, man. It's just like Ron Paul says, we either got to pay them or bomb them. But we just can't leave anyone alone ever. We'll bomb you if you don't accept our money. Better accept it. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. So here I am talking about George W. Bush serving the Ayatollah. And then the break comes, and I look to the right, and there's our old friend David Enders, who's been covering the Iraq war for a long time. I first started interviewing him 10 years ago, covering the Iraq war. Can't believe it's already 2015. Isn't that crazy? Tripping me out. Anyway, point being, here's his tweet from 6 hours ago. Never would have guessed I'd see signage like this in Karamana Square, or all over Baghdad, for that matter. And what it is, it's a picture of a billboard with the Ayatollah Khamenei, not Sistani, who at least, you know, lives in Iraq, but Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, and then a bunch of, you know, Badr Corps and whatever militia, fighter, warrior dudes. I don't read what the script says there, but the point being, Iranian heroes, Shiite fighter heroes all over Baghdad. Never thought he'd see the day, but then again, yeah, he did. Because he told me 10 years ago, yep, this is what's happening. This is what the El Salvador option means. It means hiring the guys from the Badr Brigade to hunt down and kill the leaders of the Sunni, predominantly Sunni-based insurgency. Which means, in effect, turning the occupation into a sectarian civil war. Go back and check the archives, man. They're there. Listen to David Enders from a decade ago getting this right. And here he is on Twitter today. Let's see if I can get him on the show for you this week. David Enders. He was at Al Jazeera. Was it McClatchy, then Al Jazeera, now Vice? Let me tell you about David Enders. David Enders was kidnapped by the al-Nusra Front in Syria. Not kidding. They held him for more than 2 weeks, I think, and then let him go. And he's alive now. Kidnapped by al-Qaeda in Syria. That's a badass reporter right there. Didn't even tell me either. I'm interviewing him. Hey, how's it going? Oh, things are okay. How are you doing, Scott? Oh, I don't know. I'm just sitting back here in Texas in this kind of nice place. I'm wondering how things are over there. Oh, you know, the al-Nusra Front, they're blowing stuff up. And then a few weeks after that, maybe a couple of months after that, he writes a piece called The Time That I Got Kidnapped by the al-Nusra Front. And didn't even tell anybody about it until now. Why? They try to keep the kidnappings of the reporters pretty quiet, I think, as a strategy to make negotiating over them easier. Anyway. But so there's David Enders reporting from Shiite Baghdad. And so, yeah, that's the thing about it. You know, really, the American war broke Iraq. And it was obvious even during the time when Petraeus was paying the Sunni militias to stop fighting us and the Iraqi government. And as long as they would continue fighting al-Qaeda. And he was promising them that you guys will all get jobs in the Iraqi army. He created basically separate armies. The concerned local citizens. Remember that? The Sons of Iraq. These were the former Sunni insurgents. Started working for the United States. And he said, this was the entire premise of the surge worked. Or the surge working anyway. The surge worked isn't based on any premise at all, other than it's fun to say a lot of times if you're a conservative or an idiot or both. But the premise of the surge working was that it was going to create the peace in Baghdad, that the political space could be created for compromises to be made, for the Iraqi state to be held together, for the Sons of Iraq and the concerned local citizens to be brought into the obviously now Badr Brigade, predominantly Shiite Iraqi army. And it was obvious then that it was never going to happen. It was obvious then that as long as America's paying their salaries, okay, sure. But why in the world would the Botter Brigade Army pay these guys to frag them? I mean, it's just not going to happen. So Humpty Dumpty was, he was on the wall and he was already drunk. And the spikes had been placed at his feet too. And then spring last year is when he really fell off. As Patrick Coburn warned and warned and warned and warned and warned on this show and in print in the Independent, he said, well, first in the Independent and also on this show, he said the American and Allied-backed Sunni-based insurgency civil war in Syria is re-energizing the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq. And I even had said to him that, you know, this was... He had explained that part of the reason for the ceasefire back in 2007 was because they'd lost Baghdad by then, basically. So the Sunni leadership said, we got too many enemies, man. We already lost the capital city. And we're getting cream going up against all the Iranian organized Shiite militias and the Americans and the Al-Qaeda guys at the same time. So let the Americans stand between the Shia... make a ceasefire with the Americans, let them stand between the Sunni and the Shia for a minute, and let them take care of the Al-Qaeda guys and marginalize them to the absolute margin. That was as close as you're going to get to the surge worked at all there. But, you know, I would ask Coburn back then, well, now that they've lost Baghdad, and this is, you know, the position that they see themselves in, you know, are they willing to make compromises enough with the Shiites to be brought into the government? He said it was really the question was still the other way around, whether the Shia are going to let them in or not, cooperate with them or not. And they just absolutely refused to. And why would they? George Bush had just fought the war for, not for Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite, but nationalist Iraqi. No, for Dawa and Skiri. And the Botter Brigade Army that always said what they wanted to do was break Iraq into pieces. But then Coburn started warning after the American-Saudi hijacking of the Arab Spring in Syria that, you know, where before the Sunni were, they lost Baghdad, and what are they going to do? Shrug. Now they're looking at it like, hey, instead of being the minority in Iraq, 60% majority Shiites kicked them out of the capital city, now they're zooming out a little bit. And now they're saying, yeah, but we're the supermajority in the region. And so why should we have to sit still for this? Just because George Bush used the Army and the Marine Corps to put Iran's guys in power in all of Baghdad and to kick all the Sunni population out and replace them with Shiites? Why, now that we look at, if we erase the Sykes-Picot border here, all of a sudden we're the majority again. They thought. And I said, come on, they can't retake Baghdad. It took the Army and the Marine Corps, the American Army and Marine Corps, to give it to the Shiites. How could the Sunnis take it back? And he said, yeah, but don't tell them that. And that was in, you know, he started, this was a discussion Coburn and I were having on this show in 2011 and 2012, that they're looking at it where, no, in fact, the Shiites are a tiny minority of Muslims in the world, and they are a minority, not that small, but they are a minority in the Arab world as well. And as long as momentum is with the rebellion in Syria, why should they respect that line when America has really already done their dirty work of breaking the country up? And so all that happened when ISIS rolled into Mosul last June was that this guy, Bakr al-Baghdadi, went, and that was all it took to push Humpty Dumpty off the wall and break him into 100 pieces. And there's no putting it back together again. No matter who rules Iraqi Sunni stand, they're never going back under the rule of Baghdad. It's already over. So if it's not called the Islamic State, better come up with a new name for it soon. Call it, hopefully, Iraqi Sunnistan tribal land, not Islamo-fascist caliphate as created by America's Frankenstein monster, Bakr Baghdadi, who grew up to power in America's Camp Buka prison, during that occupation and Civil War.
Hey, all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, so breaking today in The Intercept, Scahill and Josh Begley. The CIA campaign to steal Apple's secrets. So, it's just as you could have guessed. Basically, it's as any complete lunatic, strung out truther on crank, might suspect. A paranoid schizophrenic. Everything they could possibly hallucinate about the government breaking into your ones and zeros. It's all true. All of it. The audio, the emails, your location data, all of your metadata, the hard drive in your computer. Just in case you're not online. They got the bug installed right there. All of it. And so, if you were strung out on meth and you were saying, man, I'm telling you, those iPhones, those things are owned by the NSA, man. There's no way they're letting those things out. They ain't full of spyware, man. Well, of course, yeah, that meth head would be correct. It would also be the case that he would be a cokehead if it wasn't for Prohibition. And he might not be quite as paranoid, although, you know, I don't know. But yeah, man, no, that's it. That's all of it. That's what the Snowden thing is, right? And you'll even hear people who are like kind of Snowden truthers who think he's some kind of false flag thing. They go, oh, come on, everybody already knew that. Well, kind of. I mean, everybody already assumed that. Everybody who, well, I don't know everybody. Everybody who really just don't trust them. But everybody who more or less thinks that everything is more or less okay? Nah. That's what Snowden's done. He has confirmed the complete and total paranoia of all Americans on this. Of all kooks. And paranoids. And freaks. We were right. All along. And now, I'm trying to figure out exactly how it was that I've been so good on this for so long. I mean, I used to, even way back in the 90s, I would say, I guess it was because I'd read some Bamford, but it wasn't just that. You know, and I would tell people that, come on, listen, understand, the entire telecommunications infrastructure of the United States of America was built with the NSA from the ground up all along the whole time. There's nothing outside of it. All they have to do to tap your phone is just hit enter. They don't have to break into your house and put a bug on your line. They don't even have to put a bug on your line down at any kind of local switch in anything. It's all just computerized. They've got your ass, the whole thing. And honestly, I mean, I've been good on this since like 1993 when I was a sophomore in high school, or maybe before that. And I don't know why. I mean, I read 1984. And I guess I just assume, but I knew something too. Maybe, I guess I had read, The Puzzle Palace or parts of it anyway. And I think I've told y'all this story before where when I was a cab driver one time I met, Rich Texan from The Simpsons. You know him. Big fat guy, two revolvers, drinking whiskey, chomping on a cigar, cowboy hat. Piles of money that he doesn't know what to do with, coke and whores all around him. Likes to have a good time. So I had Rich Texan from The Simpsons in my cab, and he told me the story of how he and his Rich Texan brother had decided to go into the telecommunications business down in Houston, and how the scariest bastards he had ever met in his entire life were from the National Security Agency, who came to tell them, it's okay for you guys to go into this business, but here's our book of demands. and here's how you're going to do it, and that it was that they were like mafia, that there was certainly nothing lawful about any of it. But even in their entire approach, they didn't even pretend to be nice for a minute and say, hi, guys, let's do business. They came in threatening in the most kind of, heavy-handed fashion that they absolutely did not need to resort to in dealing with these Texan, you know, rich Republican businessmen who were going to do what they said anyway. And this guy said he didn't like it so bad that he left the business, left it to his brother. And went and did other things because he just said he did not want to deal with these guys. They were basically seizing control over his company. Every last little bit of it. And anyway, I think you'd have to be a fool to not assume these things. But most people are fools. Most people think that if you're ruthless, then you're an uneducated, low-level private criminal. And that if you're in public service, well, then that's the mark of kind of the highest form of human behavior. I don't know. They all tell lawyer jokes all day long, too, but then they got that cognitive dissonance, man. It's from them government schools what it is more than anything. But so that's the lesson of the Snowden documents. That's the lesson of firstlook.org/The Intercept, man, when you troll through this journalism. If you go to, here's what you search. And yes, the NSA will be watching you at the time, but what you need to do is you need to search for EFF NSA. That's the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And one of the first things that'll come up is a page called Primary Sources. You click on that. It's not just the primary sources. It's the primary and the secondary. So what it is it's a chart of all the Snowden revelations that have been reported and links to the news organizations that did the journalism, along with the list of links to all the documents that were revealed in those news stories. So you have all the first dairy and the secondary sources there for you to look at. And it's all of it. And what it proves is that, basically none of this stuff is secure at all. And of course, there are a lot of fights going on, and I'm not really literate enough in this stuff to give you the blow-by-blow, really, but there are big fights about all the cryptography, too, and, like, you know, whether the Tor network, for example, is all just one big false flag set up by the government in the first place just to nab you, whether all the end-to-end encryption systems are worthwhile, or whether it doesn't matter because they've already hacked your phone in the first place, so they have what you got before you encrypt it and send it out and this kind of thing. You know, I don't know all the details. I do know there's a lot of room for entrepreneurs to try to figure out ways of securing data. And also know that it's pretty damn easy to get away with fooling people when the technology is so complicated that such a small number of people can really understand what it does and how it works, and much less who all's behind it. And for what reasons and all that. But I do hear it said from time to time in those circles. They said what we need is an internet that is as secure as we can possibly make it by default. So yeah, fine, okay, they can crack what they can crack, but they have to crack everybody to get everything. That instead of having an internet that is purely hackable by default, everything ought to be as encrypted as possible by default. That kind of thing. And you know what? What would Jeffrey Tucker say? Jeffrey Tucker would say, oh yeah, don't worry. Free people will handle it. They're going to get around it. They're going to figure out a way to make the government controls obsolete because they have to. And I think that's mostly right. Although, I don't know, man. All this stuff is a double-edged sword. From time to time, I mention Neil Postman. I mentioned him on the show yesterday. Neil Postman wrote a few different books. You might have heard at least the titles, Amusing Ourselves to Death and The End of Education. The one I read was Technopoly, and it was about how nobody believes in nothing anymore, not enough anyway, to prevent the ultimate onslaught of technology, that any gadget that can be invented will be invented and will be implemented as soon as it's affordable in this society, whether it's worthwhile or not, whether the double-edged sword is cutting this way or that way. And You can see what he means with the cameras on the roads in every town, in every neighborhood, in every town across this land now. Cameras everywhere. Nobody ever voted on it. Very rarely did anybody ever really get a say in it. Just happens. Just goes without saying. And if they could put tracking devices in all of our pockets and make us want them and make us even pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars for them, give us some apps and we'll do it. I mean, not that it's all so premeditated as that, but that's the whole point. It's just the onslaught of technology. You know, I made that joke one time to Jim Bovard, and he said that, he made the joke that, well, in Alabama, they're trying to outlaw battery-operated sexual devices. So this is the best that we can come up with when it comes to, culture trying to resist the onslaught of technology is, conservatives violating people's free choice rather than stopping the violating of it. But anyway, it's worth a read anyway. It's been a long time. I'm not good at talking about the big ideas, but I see the world he feared coming true all around me every day. That's all. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The first of these great workshops is in Orlando, Saturday, March 7th. It's just $25. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Our first guest on the show today is John W. Whitehead. He's the author of Government of Wolves. And he runs the Rutherford Institute at rutherford.org. He's got one up there from yesterday, looks like, here. How DNA is turning us into a nation of suspects. And you can also find it over at lewrockwell.com today. Welcome back to the show, John. How are you doing?
Hey, thanks. Busy as usual.
Good. Thank you for making time with us here. I appreciate that you have taken on this subject. It's a very important one. But I also appreciate that you went ahead and put a few thousand words into it and really got to a lot of very important points, really explored this issue in a way that I don't think I've ever seen anyone do before. So thank you very much for that. Please tell us, what do Americans need to understand about the proliferation of all these government DNA databases?
Well, first of all, to understand DNA, what DNA is, it's the mapping of your body, and, it basically can detect who your ancestors were, your family. In fact, some police in some states are doing what they call familial research when they arrest somebody to find out who their ancestors are, their family members. So it's the entire mapping of your body, let's put it that way. And the leader in wanting DNA is the FBI. The FBI is amassing a huge database. They're saying by the year 2025, they could have 325 million DNA prints on their database, which means they would know exactly who you are, where you are, what you think, and all that. That's what DNA does. I mean, I would encourage your listeners to do just a little research, read a few articles on DNA, you'll see how powerful it is. But the theory they're using, the government, the FBI, and then local police now, who a lot of local police, by the way, train with the FBI, so you're just getting sort of echoes from the FBI when you're talking to local police who are into these subjects. But supposedly to solve crimes, to get people off death row, that does happen occasionally. But what DNA does is it gives the government tremendous power to use over people, basically. And if people go to Rutherford.org or go to the Lou Rockwell website, you can read my article. But it surpasses fingerprints, And the thing is now, the several Israeli scientists, and this is an article out of the New York Times, says that DNA can be fabricated as well. It's the easiest thing to put at a crime scene. So let's put it this way. If you're paranoid or you're classified as one of those conspiracy theorists, if your DNA, by the way, is shed everywhere, you can be set up at a crime scene. All it takes is a hair or just a few cells off your body. You can be implemented in any crime anywhere in the United States. So that's the basic background. But what I'm telling people is we already live in a surveillance state. I mean, the NSA is downloading all of our communications. The NSA admits to hacking into 160 Facebook pages a day. 160,000. So they're watching everything we do. If you are one of those people out there who likes to protest, you don't agree with what the government does, you're a rebel rouser, you're automatically, and we get the cases here at the Rutherford Institute. We see this. They can come get you. If they want to implement you in a crime, they will be able to do that within a few years.
Yeah. Well,
you'll have no defense, by the way, because what they've done really well, they've sold it to the public as this foolproof thing, DNA sample. It will cure everything. We can get the real criminals. But like I say, now we find out that it can be fabricated and placed at a crime scene. In fact, the Israeli scientists said all they need is access to a computer to see what your DNA looks like. They can fabricate it, recreate it, and place it at a crime scene. Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't take, the Israeli army or whatever, that kind of advanced wealthy kind of group of people in a laboratory to do it? How easy would it be to do?
It's very easy if you know what you're doing. So what I'm saying is that it can be done. And my particular belief right now, I think it's already being done. That would be my argument. I mean, if you're having scientists talking about it, it can be done. And by the way, it's been approved by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is totally backing DNA now. You really have no – and most states are moving toward – if you're just arrested, and again, there's a key Supreme Court case, Maryland versus King, the Supreme Court said if you're just arrested, they can take your DNA now. Here's the point. You're not convicted of a crime. You haven't even been on trial. They'll take your DNA. They'll put it on file. So you really have no defense against it. And that's the future of the country.
Yeah. Well, and it really sounds like a lot of this is pretty ad hoc on the part of the cops and then upheld by the judges. And to what degree we have representation in our legislatures, we don't even really get a chance to debate it at all.
You're not going to get a chance to debate. No, the courts are going to pass it. The FBI, by the way, is the organization that's pushing this really heavily. They'll be able to control, basically, some say they control the populace. That's what some scientists are saying with DNA. There's two Russian scientists, by the way, and this has not been proven, not like the Israeli scientists. They proved you can fabricate the DNA, but two Russian scientists actually say they've done tests where by electromagnetic rays, they can alter DNA from a distance. They actually took a frog embryo and turned it into a salamander doing that. So I'm not saying they're going to turn us into salamanders or anything, but let's say you are one of those rebel rousers, a Martin Luther King type, or people today that get out there and picket and stuff. If that's true, they can alter your DNA from a distance. I think sooner or later that will probably be true.
Well, and you can see how the certainty of the science behind DNA can be conflated with the certainty that it's meaningful that we claim to have found this hair at this crime scene. And so, Geez, I saw on TV that these are some really super scientists with their super sciencey science, and they say that, how else does this guy explain his DNA is there, et cetera, et cetera. And now the burden's on him, which I think is the point of this whole article, is we're all going to be basically, by default, guilty in the dock until we can somehow find a way to prove ourselves innocent.
I mean, if you're a quiet person and you don't cause trouble, you're probably not going to find yourself, but the rebel rousers out there, the people that the Rutherford Institute defends, the people who get on the picket lines out there, who get their signs, who are, uprising about police violence or whatever.
Well, hey, anybody with a job is good for getting revenue from, so you don't have to be doing anything wrong except trying to get by in the world, and you're
it's
a prime
true.
Target.
I agree. And, there have been cases I cite in the article I wrote and you go again, Rutherford.org, and read it, it shows you there have been people who have been drug in, spent 8 months in jail, and they said, oh, okay, yeah, your DNA proved, well, yeah, you weren't the guy, really. But they spend time in jail. They had to pull in experts. Here's the other thing. If you're the average citizen out there and they say, we know, we've got your DNA, we're pulling you in, in order to fight that, you're going to have to get a lawyer. It's going to cost you a lot of money. Most people give up. They can't afford legal defense in these situations. Right. So you're up against a huge bureaucracy. You're up against Supreme Court decisions allowing all this, legislatures and the FBI, local police, Department of Homeland Security, by the way, is one of the big players in this, who's handing out all the equipment to police departments across the country. So what we're facing today is if you're a free speech advocate and you want to see freedom prevail, you're going to be facing some pretty tough foes.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, we've just seen in the past couple of weeks, I'm sure you probably noticed, Radley Balco did this series for The Washington Post that is certain to win a Pulitzer Prize, I think, about the bogus bite mark racket in prosecutions in this country, putting people away. And there was another great one at The Intercept about all the fake science of so-called burn patterns, where so many people have gone to prison based on this kind of pseudoscience that so supposedly shows that they had committed arson when really they're just victims of accidental fires, et cetera. And we already know that it's not like these police laboratories are set up to do double-blind science or anything like that. The cops say, hey, tell me if this hair matches. And so obviously they're looking for a yes or whatever it is, you know, and they've been busted over and over again. Even the FBI, or maybe especially the FBI crime lab itself, has been busted for their kind of their pseudoscientific practices and their conclusion first kind of ways of doing it. While at the same time, to a juror, all of this stuff sounds just as certain as it could possibly be, you know, objective and not even a subject of interpretation. So real bad conflict there. And then, as you said, what defendant can afford their own experts to really refute? One sec, right back with John Rutherford. Whoops. John Whitehead from the Rutherford Institute. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. I'm talking with John Whitehead from the Rutherford Institute, when I get his name right. It's usually his name. And we're talking about these DNA databases, and you're saying the FBI says that in 10 years, it'll be complete, all 325 million of us by then. Is that right?
That's what they're projecting, yeah, possibly. But one reason they're projecting that is because hospitals now are taking across the country and storing newborn babies' DNA, often without knowledge of their parents. There's been a few lawsuits where parents have sued over that. Mm-hmm. But and they're storing it indefinitely. So they're taking it. If you object to that, if you don't like that, then I would be sure if you're having your child, a lot of people don't have them in hospitals these days or having midwives or whatever. But if you're having it in the hospital, I would, if you don't agree with that, you might want to object to it and ask them not to do that. But they may do it anyway.
Yeah. Well, now.
So they're taking, your child's born in a hospital, they're taking the DNA, generally.
And now, let me ask you about something that you said at the beginning there. I think you said that the cops themselves already, not universities or whoever, but the cops already are taking the DNA that they have in their databases and they are mapping out family relationships and the rest of these things?
Yeah. There are several states that are doing that. I think it's four states so far, but that's going to spread. Yeah, they can go back and find out who your immediate family members are, and scientists say sooner or later you'll be able to actually go back and trace ancestors. Let's say you have... you're related to, let's say, a Thomas Jefferson or somebody they consider to be radical, a Martin Luther King or whatever. They can, and the goal, I believe, is pre-crime. They're going to be able basically to predict if you're the type of person who might commit a crime. And a crime is not what I'm talking about, robbing a bank or something.
An offense.
A crime might be getting in a park with a picket sign.
Yeah.
It might be the troublemakers, the rebel rousers, but they'll... sooner or later, your DNA basically determines who you are, how you think, how you move, and they will be able to determine who your ancestors were. And that's the science is moving very rapidly. I think people have to understand that. Science is moving, technology and science is moving so rapidly that I don't think anybody can control it right now. I mean, who would have thought that everything you do now, your bank records, your emails, your text messages, are all swooped up by the NSA, CIA, the FBI, and Department of Homeland Security groups like that. So there is no privacy anymore, folks. Your bank records, by the way, I want to emphasize that. Everybody does electronic banking these days. They know exactly what's in your bank account. They know what books you buy. Now they want to know your family history, what's in your DNA. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, it seems like they're kind of outsourcing. They're making basically conspiracy theory machines, right? Where they get to say, oh, okay, well, you're the second cousin twice removed from Malcolm X, and so therefore we gotta blue dot on you or whatever it is. And the point being that they're taking any kind of humanity out of investigation of crime, and they're instead going fishing, looking for people first, and just looking for anything that they can get, especially on the people that they want to get. Turn everything completely upside down, and yet a computer isn't an intelligence, right? A computer spitting out a readout that says, this guy scores a 17 on the threat matrix. That doesn't actually mean anything. Not in a way where, if you took any other person and had them weigh the same facts, they would score it a 17. Whatever. It doesn't, you know what I mean? They're outsourcing the responsibility for oppressing us to the computers that they designed to oppress us.
Well, here's the key, and I'll say it again. Technology is moving very, very rapidly. Google is working with the NSA, they admit that, and developing what they call the hive mind, which will mean your cell phones, your driverless car. Pretty soon, people, there will be driverless cars on the road. Everything, your laptop, everything electronic will be fused into one hive mind, and that will be accessed by the government intelligence agency. So they'll know exactly what you're doing anywhere you do it. And Eric Schmidt, the former head of Google, said, we'll know what you're thinking before you think it. And, again, all I do is research this stuff. There has been a recent experiment showing with mice that scientists can actually implant false memories into animals. In other words, they can create happy mice when there are agitated mice. And there are some scientists now arguing for that we should be, as individuals, be able to copyright our thoughts, because coming soon is, and they're wearing these wire hats with wire on them and stuff, whatever, computers. They've actually, people can actually move objects with their mind through computers now. So we moved into a whole new terrain. But with DNA, what I'm saying is they're going to go so far back into your history, they're going to know how you think before you think it. And that's the way it's moving.
But see, that's what I'm talking about, is that's nonsense, right? DNA doesn't say what is in somebody's mind, what's in cognition or not. Good enough for government work. Same as you say in this article. They're already watching your gait and the twitches on your face, and they're having their computer come up with conspiracy theories about you because of the twitch under your eye. They might have your DNA and have the code for the curve of your nose. That doesn't mean that they know anything about what's in your mind at all, only that they can come up with an accusation, and then they can pretend that it's scientific.
Exactly. And they're going, and you use the word conspiracy theory. Yeah, I think all this is, it's the government's conspiracy theory, but it's the way you control the populace, and technology is all about control right now.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. What they mean when they use that term, when they use it accurately at all, they're talking about people who leap to conclusions and connect dots that don't necessarily connect. They're always saying that in defense of themselves. But I'm saying that's their modus operandi. That's exactly what they're doing, is they're saying, well, look, John Whitehead is connected to Scott Horton, is connected to Adam Morrow, who answers the phone in Cairo. And boy, you know who lives next door to him. And Tom Cotton wrote a letter to the Ayatollah. So that means that those two are connected too. And this and that. It's all a bunch of nonsense. It all means, and if you have a computer telling you what it means that it's guaranteed to be even more wrong. And it also guarantees that no one can be held accountable for how wrong it is either.
I know. They look at the technology systems, the computers, as authoritative today. And again, I've been writing a bit on Google. I have a new book coming out pretty soon where I talk about this, but Google says that they can basically anticipate what anybody does now. The movie Minority Report, Steven Spielberg's movie with Tom Cruise in it, was set in 2054. All the technology in that film is now available to the government. It's 40 years ahead of the curve.
Man.
40 years ahead of the curve.
Well, and so really the only thing, as Neil Postman put it, the only thing that's keeping it from full-scale deployment against us, I mean full-scale, is the old law, right? The remnants of the old constitutional system that are on their very
Right? I'm a constitutional lawyer. The Fourth Amendment's been totally dissected and flushed down the toilet. I mean, the Fourth Amendment, and it's the key provision in the Constitution. It prevents a police state. It says before you do surveillance on an American citizen, before you touch an American citizen, you have to have probable cause, some evidence of illegality. Well, if the NSA admits to downloading 1.7 billion of our emails a day. They're violating the Fourth Amendment. They're gutting the Constitution. And this DNA stuff is going to be even worse, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, listen, everybody, you got to read this article. It's really important. It's at lourockwell.com today, and it's at rutherford.org, How DNA is Turning Us into a Nation of Suspects by John Whitehead. Thank you very much, John.
Hey, thank you, sir.
All right, y'all, we'll be back with Will Grigg in just a few. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey guys, how's it going?
Good. Well, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott, and it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I'm live here, in case you didn't know. I'm live from noon to 2 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network. All right, now I got another one from lourockwell.com today. It's our good friend William Norman Grigg, a.k.a. Will Grigg, a.k.a. My favorite writer on the internet, I think. Wait, let me think about that for a second. Yeah, I really think that's it. It's the great Will Grigg. Welcome back to the show, Will. How are you doing?
Scott, I'm tremendously honored. Thank you so much for the kind words and for having me on your program this morning.
Yeah, you know what? I've probably been reading you longer in a row than anybody else that I read either. I've been reading you since the New American Magazine in high school. So that's pretty
glad that I've not exhausted your patience or...
Oh, yeah, no, I love this stuff.
For outrage.
Will Grigg, he's good on everything. Check this out. Underdogs and Overlords. That's the article today at lourockwell.com and at the great blog Pro Libertate at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And, well, go ahead and make him feel bad, Will.
That seems to be my long suit. This essay talks about one facet of the mindset of the occupation army that we call law enforcement. And it seems as if the people who adhere to that institution perceive the rest of us as something of a mirror image of their own tendencies and preoccupations. For instance, it shouldn't surprise us that the people who weaponize canines look upon family-owned pets as weapons. There's practically not a day that goes by in this country without an instant in which a police officer shoots and kills a dog that threatens him, not a police dog, but a privately owned family pet who supposedly threatens him. And this is not the sort of thing you hear on the part of mail carriers or private couriers or service personnel of any other kind who routinely have interactions with unfamiliar canines. Only police do this, as far as I can tell. And yet in Georgia, there is a measure right now being considered by the state legislature that in its original form would have made it an act of second-degree murder for a common citizen or a mundane, as I like to describe us, to kill a police dog, which would be used as a weapon in most instances, whether you're talking about a SWAT raid or a drug raid or another type of an interaction in which the police are present with dogs, they will often deploy dogs as weapons. And if you're on the receiving end of an unanticipated and unjustified no-knock raid, in the middle of the night, such as the one that occurred about a year ago, in which Boba Fasenova, this 19-month-old baby, had his chest blown open and his face mangled. If a dog's involved in a raid of that sort, and you were to grab a firearm, for instance, and shoot the dog in order to protect your family, under the bill which is being considered by the Georgia State Legislature in its original form, that would have been treated as an act of second-degree murder. That has been modified. That legislation has been modified to refer to it as aggravated assault. But it's still talking about a sentence enhancement that would lead up to 10 years in prison if you're found guilty of injuring a dog, a canine officer, who would, for the purposes of this law in whichever form, be considered a peace officer of a standing comparable to that of a human who would be his dog handler or her dog handler. And as is the case with many mischievous acts of legislation of this kind, it's named after somebody or some creature. In this instance, Tanya, I believe that's how the name was pronounced, a police dog who was killed during a SWAT raid, I believe in July of last year, against a fellow who was really quite a loathsome specimen. He was an Idaho native, as it turns out, who'd gone to Georgia on parole, and he was accused of sexual assault and a number of other crimes. There was a SWAT raid on his domicile, and during the SWAT raid, the dog was killed, and the human perpetrator was injured as well. He ended up accepting a plea bargain agreement that has the potential of a 50-year term. It's, for all intents, a life sentence, because I believe he's in his late 50s. He's going to spend at least 20 years in prison. But this was seen as a sentence of inadequate severity to the people who were attached to law enforcement, because that component of the plea agreement that involved killing a police dog was seen as inadequate. The term that was the component of the sentence was, I think, a 3 to 5 year term for destroying this police dog. And so they wanted, in the name of the memory of Tanya, who was buried with all the somber pomp and melodramatic pageantry that we would associate with the Soviet state funeral, it was a standard issue police funeral, in other words, for this dog who was killed. In the name and memory of Tanya, they wanted to enhance the status of a police dog, to elevate that that creature above human beings in terms of the criminal penalties that would attach to harming or destroying that police dog. They wanted to recognize the police dog as a fully realized peace officer, in other words. And that's just one faction, or forgive me, one demonstration, one element of what I call blue privilege, the idea that police are elevated above the common run of humanity in many ways, not the least of which, of course, is this fiction called qualified immunity. But in terms of the sentence enhancements that attach to crimes of violence that are committed against police officers, and this would once again be, I think, the first instance in which a law in the Western world, let alone the United States, would have recognized the destruction of a non-human creature as a form of murder. There are all kinds of criminal penalties that are implicated if you destroy somebody's living property in the form of livestock or a family pet or a companion animal. But prior to this year, I don't think there had ever been a serious proposal anywhere in the United States to designate as murder the conscious destruction of a dog. And it wasn't PETA who did this. It was the police unions acting through complacent members of the Georgia State Legislature, a body which is not really noted for its congeniality toward the animal rights perspective, but of course is broadly receptive to the claims of privilege made by the police and their servitors.
Yeah. Now, so tell me this, Will, because I think I even said this on the radio before, and I was sure, but then later I did some reading, and it was claimed that this was just an urban myth, but I could have swore that people had been prosecuted for murder before, for a police officer, for killing a police officer, whether the statute actually already specifically allowed for that or not, but that they just said...
For killing a police dog?
Yeah, for killing a police dog in the name of, well, it was a police officer, and that's against the law, pal.
I've not been able to find that. I did some research on my own, and I'd heard rumors as well as you had that this had been done.
I had thought I knew that one, but then, I read that, no, that's an urban myth.
I've not been able to find a criminal homicide conviction for somebody who'd killed a police dog, but I found several cases, and you're probably familiar with them, where somebody has been sent to prison for an act such as growling at a police dog or otherwise taunting a police dog. There was a case in Massachusetts where somebody allegedly taunted a police dog into injuring itself, and so he was charged with cruelty to an animal and also, I believe, some kind of an act involving abuse on a peace officer. I have found instances where people have been prosecuted or indicted for abusing peace officers or assaulting peace officers because of things they've done to police animals, such as police dogs. I've not seen a criminal homicide case yet.
Yeah.
But that would be the logical progression from where we stand right now, certainly.
Yeah, definitely.
With the absence of this law.
Well, and I know there are at least two cases, one of which I know specifically it was that imam that they set up and murdered in Detroit, where
yeah.
they let him sit there and bleed out and die on the cold concrete floor while they medevaced the dog out of there.
Exactly.
That had been shot in the exchange.
Yeah, I'd written about that case several years ago. That's
right.
one illustration of what we're talking about again. And the juxtaposition here in the case of Georgia is really quite stark, not quite as stark as letting somebody bleed out while taking the dog in for medical treatment. But I talk about the case of this 10-year-old boy, Dakota Corbett,
mm-hmm.
who was shot by a police officer in...
Actually, you know what? We're not going to have time for this story on this
right.
side of the break here. We got it coming right up. But... So that just gives us a little bit of extra time to tell people about your website again. It's Pro Libertate is the
yeah.
name of the site. It's freedominourtime.blogspot.com. The book is called Liberty in Eclipse, and you can also find at Will's website, you can find his weekly podcast, which is just great, as you can tell, because it's a lot like this. It's like my show sounds when Will is on it. It's great. So check that out. And again, his article today is What's Your Status Before the Law at LouRockwell.com. And we'll be back in just a minute. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Will Grigg. Pro Libertate is the blog, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Also regularly writes for LouRockwell.com. His podcast is called The Freedom Zealot. And you can find that at the bottom of any entry at Pro Libertate. It says, really small, click here for The Freedom Zealot. All right, so we're talking about police dogs and how their lives are worth more than yours, of course, because, you know, they work for the state. And how we really are getting that way. They're even trying to pass this law in Georgia. Now, you said, Will, that at first they were going to make it a possible second-degree murder thing, but
yeah,
now they've had to back off of that. I wonder why they've had to even back off. Are people pushing back against this in Georgia?
Modest groundswell of indignation over this, altogether too modest. I think that most people are criminally indifferent to what's going on in the laboratories of mischief called state legislatures. And so this is the sort of thing that probably would have been able to pass in its unfiltered form if it hadn't been for the fact that a few local media outlets picked up on the story and generated a little bit of pushback. But it's an abiding testament, I think, to the formidable power of the police unions in Georgia and elsewhere that any version of this measure, Tanya's Law, as it's called, is likely to be passed, especially in light of the fact that there's a contending piece of legislation, actually several, that have been grouped under the heading of Boo Boo's Law. Boo Boo, once again, or Bow Bow. I can't remember which variant of that pronunciation is correct, but the 19-month-old child of Vietnamese or perhaps Hmong ancestry, who was almost killed during a 2 a.m. SWAT raid about a year ago when a flash bang grenade was hurled into the crib where he was sleeping. The family were refugees from a house fire in Wisconsin. They ended up living with a relative in Georgia, and a paid informant looking for a downward departure on a criminal sentence, no doubt, offered unsupported testimony that a $50 drug transaction had taken place at that address, on the evening prior to the raid, and they got a no-knock raid, which, as it happens, is illegal under Georgia law, as a defense attorney, I quote, points out. And so they kicked in the door and threw in a flashbang grenade, blew up in a hole in this 19-month-old child's chest, blew his face almost almost completely, permanently disfigured his face. His nose was blown off. He's had to undergo surgeries and medical care that have left the family more than $1 million in debt. I mean, no consequences at all for that. There are a couple of measures that have been proposed that would enact some modest restrictions on the practice of no-knock raids, but in doing so, they would actually legalize something that is not legally permissible in the state of Georgia right now. But the Boo-Boo's Law, whatever configuration, is not finding traction, but Tanya's Law is. Now, Boo-Boo's Law is a bad idea. I want to underscore that fact. I don't think that they should be putting restrictions on a practice that's impermissible. But the point is that it's not finding traction because, as one police union flunky pointed out, no-knock raids are considered to be already sufficiently or perhaps exceptionally or extraordinarily impermissibly difficult to obtain. What she said, Carrie Mills, she's a representative of the International Brotherhood of Police Officers, I don't think any changes needed because it's not easy now to get a no-knock warrant. And then she said, you have to draw the line between your right as a citizen to privacy and a community's right to live in a crime-free environment. You can't have both.
Yeah, hilarious. Now,
obviously, they're not going to create a crime-free environment by conducting post-midnight no-knock raids. That, of course, is a fiction of the sort that we routinely hear from people who are acting on behalf of the putative apparatus. But the point is, as far as she's concerned, you have to live in a community where police are perfectly free to kick down doors at 2 in the morning and burn infants in their cribs. That's simply a trade-off you have to make for living in a community. And another trade-off you have to make here is to recognize that while the police have the right to kill your dog on sight, and in the case of this young man, Dakota Corbett, I mentioned before the break, actually they have the right to shoot a child while they're trying to shoot your dog, and no consequences will attach to the police officer. On the other hand, if you happen to harm a canine peace officer in whatever circumstance, then perhaps rather than being prosecuted for second-degree murder, you'll be prosecuted for aggravated assault on a peace officer, right, and you'll spend 10 years in prison rather than 20. I mean, that's the concession they're willing to make to your interests as they define them.
A canine peace officer. I just love that. And by the way, of course, the point of this, you know, that lady's argument, the police union representative's there's argument, is self-refuting. I mean, the entire controversy was over a case where they didn't have to prove to the judge that the guy they were after was even there. Did the judge even ask, are you sure the guy's there? Do you know if there are other other people there who could be armed? Or what level of surveillance have you been carrying out in the lead-up to this raid? And in other words, her argument is that it's really hard to get a warrant, but we see no evidence of that at all. We see a post-midnight SWAT raid on an innocent little child. And the suspect, who was wanted for the non-crime of selling meth to someone who wanted to buy some meth from him, or a cop who was pretending to want to,
It
wasn't even on the premises, wasn't even on the property at the time.
No, it wasn't even in the neighborhood.
So completely, her argument is completely falls flat up against the controversy, which, she was called to comment on in the first place. But anyway, so I just wanted to tie that up before I let you talk more about the story of the cop that shot a child while trying to kill the dog. That was his excuse. Well, I was just trying to kill the dog.
Sure. Yeah, Michael Vickers is the name of the police officer, and he was pursuing somebody who was accused of shooting a fellow officer after an armed robbery, and that, of course, is a significant crime. If you're committing an act of violence in order to escape, rather than being apprehended for committing a previous act of violence, you're a criminal. So they were looking for an actual criminal. But rather than actually pursuing the criminal, who apparently was in the neighborhood, and at the time he wasn't armed, he was, as I understand it, sitting behind this family's pathetic, tatterdemalion little dwelling. It was a double-wide trailer, I think, basically trying to blend in with his surroundings. He was in the backyard. The dog didn't alert to the suspect. I find that really interesting. But the dog did alert to the presence of a guy who was approaching their property with a drawn gun, emitting an odor of incipient violence. The dog alerted to that and then bounded out into the front yard, into the living area. The 10-year-old was standing next to the dog, and Mr. Vickers, displaying what I call a good enough for government work marksmanship, fired a single round at the dog and hit the kid in the leg, and then the kid was taken to the hospital tardily, as it happens. I saw an interview with the boy's sister, and she was talking about how they did what they could through direct pressure and just grabbing bedding and towels and such like to prevent the kid from bleeding to death. Eventually, he got to the hospital, but from what I understand, there have been complications, and he'll never have the full function of that leg again. And there's neither criminal or civil liability that attaches to this, because at the very least, you'd have to consider this to be an act of negligent assault.
So they delayed calling the ambulance, or they delayed allowing the EMTs to treat the boy, or what?
I didn't get the details about how the scene was locked down, but the point is the family, because of their lack of resources in the remote area they lived in, weren't able to get immediate medical attention. They had to be the first responders there until they were able to get the kid to the hospital. And from what I understand, they didn't get an ambulance out there. They had to drive the kid to the hospital. And so you're dealing here most likely with the sort of thing that happens, first of all, because of the remoteness of the location and the impecunious nature of the family, but also this was a crime scene, an active crime scene, and he wasn't their first priority.
So they weren't allowed to go until the cops said, you're allowed to go. Yeah. And by then, some amount of time had passed in this emergency.
And more importantly, I think, it wasn't the police officer who rendered aid. You know, you shoot a kid,
right.
It seems to me that your first priority is to make sure the kid's okay.
But no, because that is an admission that you did something wrong right there.
And they never admit this. You know, this is something else I've written about regarding the case of Bobo Vesenova. They've since relocated. The family's relocated back to Wisconsin. They're living in the Madison area now, that's the capital of the state of Wisconsin. And they were promised by the county where this took place that the county would absorb at least some of the medical expenses. And, of course, the county commissioners reneged on this, saying it would be illegal to do so. And what they meant by that is that they'd expose themselves to liability. The grand jury that examined this case actually cut the family in for a share of the blame here on the assumption that there was criminal activity going on at the home. No such activity was ever proven, of course. But the fact that the police raided the home at 2 in the morning must mean that there was something wrong going on there, so they have to be at least partially to blame. There's a police officer from the state of Wisconsin, whose name eludes me right now, who a couple of months ago put out a self-pitying essay talking about how his feelings are hurt because the public is ungrateful for the service that he provides, and it's just too bad that they see all the horrible things that happen, none of the good things. He is a neighbor, for all intents and purposes, of the Vesenova family. They live within 10 or 12 miles of where he lives there in Wisconsin. Why doesn't he organize with his fellow public-spirited police officers a charitable foundation or a charitable outreach program to raise money for the Vesenova family to help defray the expenses that were imposed upon them? He doesn't do this because that would admit that there's something wrong institutionally with the profession that he has chosen, that they're to some extent responsible for this type of horrible thing happening to an innocent child. They can't make that admission.
Right. All right, now, so let me ask you this, though, because this is important. I like to try to end on a happy note, and since we're a minute over time anyway here, or a few seconds now, what about the pushback kind of nationwide? People really are getting sick and tired of this, and different versions of Cop Watch and different things like this seem to be cropping up all over the place. As we've talked about before, you have the confluence of everyone having a high-quality video camera in their pocket. Hold your phone sideways, people, on video, please.
Yep.
Thank you. And Facebook and Twitter that make it possible to share these things immediately. And I'm seeing, even in mainstream news now, they can't help but cover it. LA Times covering a local police shooting in some county nobody ever heard of in Kentucky somewhere or whatever, that it's just local police shootings, more and more national news stories. There's just no way around it. People are getting sick and tired of people I know who don't know about or care about politics say to me, Scott Horton, what is going on with the cops lately, man? It's like they're just out of control. And I wonder whether you think that a difference is being made in any real way.
The fact that people are discussing this is progress. The fact that people who are within, if you will, the guardian class of the media, the gatekeepers, are at least willing to acknowledge the problem is progress, because you and I have been butting our heads against this wall for how many years now, and finally, at least we're finding at least some traction on the subject. Mm-hmm. I do think, I can't remember who it was who said this, in responding to my concept of peak jackboot, was asked if we reached the point of peak jackboot where people are at least willing to acknowledge that there's an institutional problem with law enforcement. It's not just a handful of rogues. It's something institutionally that's gone wrong. He said, I don't know if we've reached peak jackboot, but we may have reached peak obedience or peak submission. Mm-hmm. And I think that happened last year. And this year, of course, in the dialectic, we're seeing the pushback on the part of the voices and the interests that represent the state's coercive apparatus. And I think this year we're going to see them escalating, a counter-escalation on their part. And it's going to get nastier. I've long said that what will happen after the public finally realizes the problem is that the snapback from the embedded institutional interests is going to be that much more violent. And I think that's where we are this year. I think this year we're going to see some additional, perhaps even more lurid examples of really ugly, violent efforts to suppress what's going on. But in the long term, I think that they've lost their legitimacy and they're not going to recover it. And I think within maybe the next 10, 12 years or so, that we're actually going to see some efforts to decentralize, to break up the mass, and to challenge the assumptions that are behind this really strange enterprise that we call law enforcement. I don't know if you've discussed this with the other guests, but when people ask me what should be done about law enforcement, I said law enforcement should be abolished. We should break up the state security monopoly because law enforcement is in no way devoted to the protection of persons and property. And any protection we derive from that is entirely tangential to its purpose, which, as we've seen in Ferguson and elsewhere, is to extract revenue at gunpoint and to monetize trivial misconduct for the benefit of the political class. I think we're going to start having that conversation. It's badly overdue, and I think that in the intermediate term, there's cause for optimism. In the immediate term, however, I think things are going to get uglier.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. But again, in that Rahm Emanuel Condoleezza Rice way, in the long term, we'll benefit from it because the kind of as the gloves are off, so's the mask. And so anyway, I was going to say something great, but now I can't remember what it was anymore. But thanks very much, Will. I sure appreciate you having on the show again.
Okay, you take care, Scott. It's always great to talk.
You too, man. All right, y'all. That's the great William Norman Grigg. Will Grigg at freedomandourtime.blogspot.com, the Freedom Zealot podcast as well. Just page down and you'll find the link at the bottom of the page there. And find him today at lewrockwell.com as well. The article is, What's Your Status Before the Law? Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.